ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. The cost of raising a kid hasn't actually changed much in the past few decades, according to new research, to which I, a parent, say, what? Raising kids is an expensive exercise, but it is an expense that many of us say we're happy to shell out. And thinking about this has got me thinking, what do you reckon is the best money you ever spent on your kids? Private school fees? Travel? A box of colouring pencils? A footy? I'll be taking your calls in the next 20 minutes. Plus, more on buying for kids, how to choose toys that aren't toxic, after a new report finds popular toys with high levels of dangerous chemicals. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, where we get our power from is changing as more renewables feed into the energy grid. There has been a massive uptake of rooftop solar around the country, and the government has subsidies to encourage more households to buy batteries, which is great if you own your home. But if you rent, or if you live in an apartment and you can't put panels on the roof, you've largely been locked out of the benefits. In a small way, that changed this week. The government's announced plans to give households free electricity for 3 hours a day in an effort to encourage energy use at the time of the day when excess solar power is being fed into the grid.
There is so much power in the middle of the day now that often prices are very cheap or negative, and this should be something by our analysis that energy companies can incorporate and offer.
So that's your Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, detailing that plan. How else can we make sure that Australia's energy transition is fair and equitable? Well, in just a tick, you'll meet the founder of a startup that's about to start trialling home batteries that renters or apartment dwellers can take with them when they move. But first, let's unpack the government's plan a little bit more with Dr. Saul Griffith, the founder of Rewiring Australia. Saul, what do you make of the policy?
Oh, this is generally moving us, the whole country, in the right direction. This, we know that if we want to make our lowest cost energy system, we maximise our rooftop solar and we share that electricity that's generated locally with local people. Now, we can argue whether this is the perfect way to do it, this 3 hours free in the middle of the day, but it's definitely a step in the right direction and signals to the energy companies that they need to make this free electricity available to more people more of the time.
So can we talk a bit about what it would actually mean for a household? Let's say I use those free daytime hours to run my dishwasher or do my washing, my washing machine. How much is that actually going to save me off my energy bill?
You know, if you did your dishwashing or your clothes washing in that 3 hours, you'd save about 50 cents on each per day. If you heated your hot water during that period, you'd save about $1 a day. And if you charged an electric car during that period, you'd save about $5 a day. So this could be significant. If you add all of that up over the course of the year, you could save close to $1,000.
So you expect there to be a large uptake. It's great if you're at home for those 3 hours in the middle of the day. Maybe you're running your air conditioner, but perhaps if you're not at home, you're not really able to make the most of it.
Yeah, it requires that your devices to have timers on them. Most new appliances do. It may not be true in a lot of rental properties in Australia, so we need to also figure out how to help Australians get those smarter devices. The other problem is that it's a opt-in program, so you're probably going to have to negotiate or call your energy provider. Australians are famously disengaged with their electricity bills. We get shocked by the number, but it's hard to change plans. And so I'm hoping that we figure out a way to make sure that everyone gets in on the plan, and that's going to be hopefully by making them opt-out plans, not opt-in plans.
Okay, so what I'm hearing baked into that answer there is that there's a lot of onus on the consumer at the moment. Do you think that that's the right way to set up a proposal like this?
I think that we really should be holding the energy companies to task, and we should look at national energy market reform, particularly the electricity market. This, apparently, to the people who are in that market, was a bit of a surprise. To householders, a bit of a surprise. But it is at least putting the market on notice. But I would like to see representation of the Australian household in, you know, in the voting board bodies of our regulatory agencies. We don't have that representation today. And I think that is necessary if we really want the Australian household represented fairly in this energy transition.
So there's no such thing as a free lunch. Some experts are saying that cheaper power during one part of the day could lead to higher prices at others. What is the risk there?
That won't be true long term, and certainly the government needs to have some sticks as well as these carrots. And by sticks, I mean they need oversight on the energy companies to make sure that they aren't stealing from us elsewhere. We know that the large generators are already manipulating the market to be able to charge their exaggerated peak prices. More and more batteries mean that those peak prices should go away. If we do this transition right, we should be able to use the wires and the poles more, which should make the electricity come down for everyone. But it's only going to happen if we make sure that the rules are written to that effect.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Dr. Saul Griffith from Rewiring Australia about the government's new proposal to make, give everyone three free hours of electricity in the middle of the day to sort of try to spread that load out across the day as more and more solar power is being fed into the grid, especially at that time. And one person who is trying to make it easier for renters and apartment dwellers to get in on the benefits here is Davood Dehestani. He's the CEO and founder of energy startup Smartizer. Davood, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Tegan. Thank you.
So you're about to start a trial for home batteries that renters or apartment dwellers can use and that you can take with you if you move. Where did the idea for this come from?
Yeah, so we saw actually a huge gap in the market. Basically, most clean energy solutions are built for homeowners. Renters were simply excluded. So the whole idea was just back to probably... from my own experience, back to 7 years ago, I was renting and I noticed my electricity bill was rising sharply. So mainly because of time of the use tariff. And my peak usage was like hot water, you know, cooking, everything just come to the most expensive hours. I realized easy I can shift this, usage to the middle of the day and save a lot of the money. And that's simple. Just come and when I afford to say, okay, this two way. One way, obviously, you can just move the your loads to the middle of the day. Another way is just shifting the cheaper energy electricity to the afternoon with a portable battery. Can be plugged like any of appliance. That's the idea came from.
So a portable battery you can plug in, use that electricity when it's cheap, take that with you when you move. Do you think it's a cost that renters will be willing to pay for?
Well, with this program from government, 3 hours free electricity definitely is really a good one, because if we just bring something in front of the renters and say, here we go, that's some, something like your appliance, cost you X dollar and then pay back you in 2 to 3 years. I think anyone is ready probably, or at least most of the people are ready to just pay for it because they can see a major benefit out of it. And especially if they know that's their own, asset, they can take it with themselves. They can just resell. They can do whatever they want, and it will work for 15 years. You know, in sense, this is just a simple solution for them.
When are you expecting to roll this out? What's the timeline?
We are in the last stage of grid connection and standard. So we potentially get the thing sorted by end of this year in the next couple of months. And we try to get rollout around 1,000 units earlier next year, toward mid next year, so for testing and trial, mainly to understand a few matters from customer points, from whether renters like it, what they don't like about our product, and how we can improve the product, you know, fit for that category of the users. So that's the plan for early next year.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National, and you're telling me about your solar setup or your energy setup at home. Dave says we heat our hot water during the day from solar. Hot water makes up about a third of bills. If we all shift to do that, big benefits in the grid and consumers don't need to be at home. Greg says free energy in the middle of the day doesn't help me for a lot of the year as I have solar panels and a battery. Getting a better price for my solar to the grid, on the other hand, dot, dot, dot. And Phil's asking, if I don't have a smart meter, how can I benefit from the 3-hour free access to power under this policy, which really speaks to equity of access, Saul. Can talk to me about what consumer needs to be able to take advantage of the new policy.
Well, you need to live in New South Wales, South Australia, or Southern Queensland. It's not gone to the rest of the Australian grid yet. And you need a smart meter. Most homes have a smart meter at this point. Some people have resisted, and in some areas it has not been made available. We really should be making sure that every single home has a smart meter. We know that that is necessary to make the grid of the future that we all need work. We know that that's going to help us on climate, and we know that it's going to help us on lowering energy bills. So I think the government compelling the remaining homes through incentives and otherwise to get those smart meters to be able to participate in this, you know, not just cheap but free energy, that should happen.
We also just heard from Davood talking about this idea of batteries for renters. There's other cloud-based startups that are offering renters a way to have more of a stake in the energy transition. Are these useful additions to the mix, in your opinion?
I think we need to try everything, and some of these entrepreneurs will get it right. I think we also need to make sure that we structure the market, and we need to think bigger as a nation. Honestly, you know, we spend $165 million a day on petrol as a country. We could be using that free electricity to charge our cars. That would be the best thing we could do for climate. That means making sure that there's vehicle charging at workplaces and where cars are during the day. That would be a wonderful complementary piece of policy to go with this. We need to compel higher building standards so that the buildings that the renters are in have the appliances and have the smart meters and have the batteries. So, you know, this is good policy moving in the right direction, but we can afford to be much more ambitious because it will make energy cheaper for everyday Australians.
Saul, Davood, thank you both so much for joining me. Dr. Saul Griffith is the founder of Rewiring Australia, and Davood Dehestani is the CEO and founder of energy startup Smartizer. Thank you for your texts as well. One says, great to hear this discussion. An issue is awareness and willingness to deal with the complexities because not everyone is an energy nerd. Well, stick with me because coming up next on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National, I'm asking you, what's the best money you ever spent on your kids?
Tasmanian salmon. It's on dinner plates across Australia. And it's a billion-dollar business with jobs for Tassie. But it's a lightning rod for locals too, concerned about its environmental impact. Radio National's next citizen jury comes from the Huon Valley, where citizens share their solutions. Join me, Natasha Mitchell, for Citizen Jury on Big Ideas. Wednesday, 8 p.m, Thursday midday on ABC Radio National.
If you could, you'd give your kids the world, right? I know I would. But these days, everything feels like it's getting more expensive. Groceries, housing, just keeping the lights on, especially if you don't have rooftop solar, as we were just talking about. So maybe our kids will have to settle for as much of the world as we can afford to give them. Well, new research suggests having kids isn't really more expensive than it was a few decades ago. So why does it feel like it is? In a moment, I'll unpack with you just how much it costs in today's dollars to raise a child to 18, and you will hear how one mum's dedication to her daughter's dream took her all the way to the Olympics. But I also really want to hear your story this morning. What is the best money you ever spent on your kids? If you're listening on the ABC Listen app, just hit the call-in button and tell me what the best money is that you ever spent on your kids. Maybe it wasn't a big amount. It was a footy boots that launched a love affair with sport, or the tutor that finally got them to appreciate the beauty of mathematics, or a trip overseas that opened their eyes to a world bigger than themselves. And with me is Associate Professor Ben Phillips, author of the study that looked into how much it costs to raise a kid. He's from the ANU Centre for Social Policy Research. Ben, welcome to Life Matters.
Hello.
Tell me, I think we need to start with the bad news. What does it cost to raise a kid to 18 in 2025?
Yeah, so the first kid, roughly about $350,000. The second kid, about $250,000. So a fair bit of money. Another way of looking at it would be maybe 15% of your after-tax income for the first and about 10% after-tax income for the second.
So my understanding of, at least the way I read your study, was that it is not that much more than it was, say, 25 years ago. But we talk constantly about the cost of living. How can both of these things be true?
Look, what the research showed is that the cost of raising a child hasn't really changed as a share of your income, at least since about 2000, 2001, when the University of Melbourne's Hilda survey first started. So not too much of a change there. But look, I think maybe I'm a bit cynical, but we do talk an awful lot about cost of living, and I think maybe it's a little bit overblown, and the media talks about it a lot, so we hear about it a lot. So perhaps it's more the perception of the cost of living having changed than the actual reality. Obviously, that doesn't mean that it's not expensive to raise kids. It is expensive today, and it was expensive in the past, but I'm not sure it's all that much different.
Yeah, fair enough. So, and we sort of get some economies of scale where you have 15% that you're spending on the first kid, but maybe slightly less on subsequent kids, just really cementing that inferiority complex that younger kids sometimes have with their older siblings. But we're also having fewer kids.
Yes. So, I mean, people often align it up with the cost of living or the cost of kids being the driver, and maybe sometimes that's the perception. But I think it's probably some longer-term things that have gone on. So, for example, back in the 70s and so on, around that time, contraception became much more prevalent. So obviously that means you have fewer kids, or usually does. Beyond that, we've also got workforce participation amongst females has increased substantially. So people have got a lot more choices, particularly women have got a lot more choices. So they're still having kids, but they're not having as many kids. So maybe in the 70s you might have had three or four kids. Now you're more likely to have one or two kids rather than three or four kids.
Maybe she thought she was only going to have one, but she actually got twins. Christine, tell me about the best money you spent on your boys.
Okay. Well, I wasn't very good at math. And I had one boy who was really good, but the other one who was struggling, and these are twin boys. So I decided to get maths coaching for them twice a week, even at one stage. And it's the best money I ever spent. Both went off and did electrical apprenticeships, and one went on to university, won a scholarship and went on to university and is an electrical engineer. The other one is high up in the electrical trade. And the tradie fella said, with electrical apprentices, don't bother coming if you can't do maths.
Christine, I can hear the pride in your voice. Thank you so much for the call. Ben, do we have a sense of where you get the biggest return on investment with what you spend on your kids?
Look, I don't think so. I think it's probably just the love that you have for your children is probably what I would think of as a father of three is the main area of return. Look, there's not much choice you have about it once you've had kids. You obviously can't take them back. And I think most people, if you were to ask them, they would probably, it'd be very unusual for anybody to say, look, I wish I didn't have, you know, my second kid or even my first kid or my third kid. I think we all love them. They can be trouble at times, and they obviously are quite expensive. But I think the benefits clearly outweigh the costs for most people anyway.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Associate Professor Ben Phillips from the ANU Centre for Social Policy Research about just how much it costs to raise a kid these days. I've also got a couple of texts here. Tara says, the best money I spent is for my son to do little athletics and state championships. He wants to go to the Olympics. He's gone to state championships in track, field and cross country. He's more confident and has more friends, which really is something that my next guest has in common, Robin Titmus. Her name might sound familiar because you would have seen her cheering on her daughter, Ariane, in the 2020 and 2024 Olympics. Robin, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you, Tegan. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about what it took to get Ariane to the Olympics, because it really was a whole of family investment.
It was. And look, it's funny when you have children, and this is of great interest, you know, the expense and being as a parent, being prepared for that is one of the things is allowing your children, I think, when they're young, to experience a lot of different activities, sport or music or dance, whatever it might be. And to see your children be happy, I think that's really important. And both our daughters, Ariane and her sister Mia, they were busy little girls when they were younger, and we were in Tasmania, and there was dancing, and we had property. So I have a love of horses, so they had some ponies. They got involved in pony club, but we'd always had a swimming pool at home, and the girls would love to get into the pool and invite friends over. And so both of them really enjoyed that, and that led to joining a little regional swimming club and training sessions and competition for fun. But they were still doing other sports as well. You know, they were involved in dancing, and Mia was involved in track and field. And then it sort of clicked. They hit an age where they want to get more competitive and they're enjoying it. And, you know, they really need to then make a choice if they want to take something on more seriously. And Ariane did that at probably about age 11 or 12. So, you know, we sold horses, her sister pursued track and field with little athletics as well as swam. But Ariane decided she wanted to put everything into swimming. And it was at that point, I think, when she made that decision and said to Steve and I really want to swim. I love competing. I want to see how far I can go. Can I move clubs? Can I go to a really good coach? So it was probably in those, you know, early teenage years. And then it's just supporting your kids through that journey when they show so much commitment and dedication and their absolute love of it. And as parents, you know, it just makes your heart full when you see what they're experiencing going through an interest that they love so much.
But you moved states for her swimming career.
We did. And I look back now and think, wow, that, you know, that was 10 years ago. And the reality was, being from Tasmania and her winning national gold medals sort of at 13 and then again at 14 and being named on the Australian team to go to Singapore for the Junior World Championships, we understood the challenges that would be there for her from a competition perspective, from coaching. Also, Tassie's not really geared up for swimming, you know, 12 months of the year with indoor council pools, and it was very expensive as parents through the council system. And so we realised that for her to pursue an international career that we would have to pack up and move to a place where swimming is, you know, it's in your blood. And Southeast Queensland is exactly where we chose based on, you know, the facilities in Southeast Queensland through the college system and the coaching, but also the squads. The squads were really important, and making friends and being really where the nucleus of swimming is in Australia.
Robin, I really want to hear more of your and Ariane's story, but first, Tim has called in. Tim, you're still spending money. What's your son's thing?
Good morning, Tegan. Thanks for the program. Our son went to the local car club on the Come and Try Day and showed some genuine talent. So since then, it's been buy a car for him to race, car trailer to pull it with, upgrade the work ute. So, yeah, I reckon we put off a retirement about 5 years so far.
My goodness, that sounds like a really expensive hobby, Tim. Have you ever totaled up how much you reckon you've spent?
Oh, 50K finance, 10 grand for the car trailer, and about 6 grand so far on the car without modifying it yet.
Well, hopefully he wins some races and you get that money back. Tim, thank you so much for the call. Robin, it's a bit crass. I sort of said that to Tim just then and, you know, oh, yeah, I hope he, like, kind of wins his money back. But there is a sense of how much you invest and what the payoff is. Ariane's won 8 gold medals. Do you reckon that's a return on investment?
Oh, who would have thought when we made the decision to move? You know, the last thing we wanted was to put pressure on her that she, you know, then had to go on and achieve. But thank goodness we did. Thank goodness we made that choice. And, you know, that meant packing up and leaving full-time jobs in Tasmania and living separately. Steve lived separately from us for 6 months because he still had a permanent role in Tassie and had to sell the house. And I moved to southeast Queensland with the girls into a little apartment. And oh, gee, I'm just, you know, so thankful that we decided as parents to give her that opportunity. And, you know, we've enjoyed a wonderful experience with her along the way. And, you know, and her sister Mia has been able to witness that and see her compete overseas. But I must say, it wasn't easy. There were times where you had to buy a you know, $400 swimming suit that would wish she had one ripped literally in the start of a race. And, you know, you would have them at for Christmas presents and birthday presents, and the family holiday was centred around going to swimming events. So you really do have to, you sacrifice a bit along the way, but it's funny how you make it happen. And that's why, you know, we've got parents too. Parents working is to provide for their kids. And as parents, you know, I think you sign up for that when you decide to have them. And so we're just so thankful that we took the gamble and made the move for our whole family.
Ben, I'm listening to Robin's story and just thinking about, obviously there's expenses in there, like things that you shell out money for, but there's so much that you can't really quantify that you're spending on your kids, even if it's not money. How did you account for that in your work?
Is trying to do this. The obvious way to do it is what's called the budget standards approach. That's where you literally try and come up with a basket of goods and services you need for those for that kids for the, well for one kid or two kids or however many kids you've got. That probably seems the logical approach. The way we did it though was we use what's called the living standards approach, and with that you look at say a couple with no kids. They might have an income of $100,000. And then you try and work out statistically using financial stress measures how much more income they'd need to have the same level of financial stress or the same living standards if they had one kid or two kids or three kids. And that's roughly where we get this sort of 15% concept or number from for the first kid and 10% for the next one. So it's a statistical approach, not perfect. None of them are perfect, but that's the way that we chose to go with this research.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Associate Professor Ben Phillips, who's done research into what it costs to raise a kid from zero to the age of 18 these days, roughly 15% of your income, give or take, depending on how much you earn. And Robin Titmus, who is Ariane Titmus's mum, yes, the Olympian, on what she and her family sacrificed to basically give Ariane the best shot at success as she could, and definitely, no matter how you cut it, that one paid off. Andrew, what's the best money you've spent on your kids?
The best outlay we ever made was about 3 weeks after she was born. We bought shares in Commonwealth Bank in her name, and then two more lots of them after that. Not large amounts, but given the appreciation over the years, it's paid for many years of education and overseas trips and all sorts of other things. So it was a lucky choice, but very, very worthwhile.
That's a really clever one. Andrew, thanks so much for the call. Yeah, Ben, we keep sort of using this, invoking this term return on investment. In Andrew's case, it's quite literal.
Yeah, certainly was in that case. That's quite wise and quite savvy. Not everybody, of course, has the opportunity to go and get shares. And another approach that you do have with government is that if you're low income, the government does provide some what are called family payments, which to some extent can pay for not all the kids' expenses, but a reasonable share of them. So there are different ways for funding children, but that's certainly one way and quite a clever way of going about it.
You're also sending me some beautiful texts. Paula says, the best thing you can give your child is your time. That's a luxury many people don't have now, but they don't really need extravagance. We only had one child as we only had one secure income, and it felt it was better to give one child a great start. We invested in music, maths, bushwalking, and just doing things together. Another says, the best money I spent for my kids was on my own therapy and learning how to be the kind of parent I wanted to be for them. Intergenerational change for good feels amazing and powerful and is a gift for all of us. And JJ says, the best money I ever spent on my children was for them to visit Ireland and connect with their families and their roots. It gave them a better perspective of their lives in a multicultural Australia. I love the way you're interpreting this in different ways. And Robin, I'm interested to know from you, there's no doubt that you and your whole family made a huge sacrifice for Ariane. Were you ever worried, or did she ever talk about feeling pressured to perform because of the level of sacrifice?
No, and that was a really big priority for us in that at the time, Steve and I camouflaged it into a sea change and an exciting adventure and, you know, being able to provide opportunities longer term for employment or university where we could stay together as a family unit rather than potentially the girls having to leave us if we stayed in Tasmania. But at the end of the day, the reason for the move was because of the opportunity for her with the swimming. But I, as a parent, am so, I suppose, proud of the fact that to this day, Ariane says that she never found it, she never felt any pressure. And so that makes me feel really good about how we did it. And because that's the last thing you want is for your kids to feel that the family is sacrificing and mum and dad are, you know, running them around to training and spending money on them and then expecting results. And look, and I think going through the whole journey of sport too has been wonderful for them to grow as individuals and to learn a lot about life, you know, learning how to be organised and self-motivated and overcoming challenges and injury. And you know, although we invested financially to make the move, I pick up on the point earlier about investing your time and parenting. We then went to, once she became independent herself, we went to more of a supportive role and providing a home where she was able to switch off of a night, walk in from training and forget about swimming if she wanted. And there were nights where we didn't discuss it. We would allow her to just be a kid at home and enjoy that sort of lifestyle. So I think it changes too as they grow up. But yeah, it's been a wonderful, wonderful journey.
Gail, the lesson for your daughter didn't cost money, but it taught her a lot about money. You can tell me the story.
Sure did. So she is really, really good with money as a result of my husband and she used to go out collecting aluminium cans. And if you got a big sackful, you took them to the recycling place and they gave you money. And that money was all hers. So she used to save it and then she'd go and she'd buy a doll or whatever it was she wanted at the time, or a CD as she got older. And that has given her such an appreciation, not only of money, but of littering. Because if you ever look around, there are always empty Coke cans, or I shouldn't say that on the ABC, empty cans of various types, left on walls, left behind plants, just on the grass, on parks. So it was a double-edged sword, but the greatest thing was this appreciation of money. Because like from when she was 4 or 5, they go out together and look for aluminium cans.
That is wonderful. Money literally on the ground. Gail, thank you so much for that call. And thank you for your texts here as well. One says, the best money I spent on my daughter was to support her exchange student experience to Germany. She came home with a second language, loads of confidence and independence. She also had another mother to take her through those difficult late teen years. I was very grateful for that. And her host mother was very aware of the big service she'd given me. Sonia says the best money I spent for our daughter is giving up work to go part-time to help her with homework and do extra tutoring with her. She's dyslexic and coping so much better. She's the youngest of three, and I said to my husband, we will never get this time again. So, Ben, I know that you're normally number crunching, but looking through the lens of what you've discovered, hearing these stories today, what's the advice to parents on how to view the money they spend on their kids?
I'm not quite sure.
Just to put you right on the spot there.
I'm more of the number crunching guys here, sort of the total cost of a kid. Look, I think probably the advice I'd give is that I don't think that it's probably quite on the monetary side. I think for most people, you really do have the choice there of whether you want to devote your time more to kids or whether you want to devote your time more to career and other opportunities. It is challenging to do both, but it is also quite possible, and a lot of Australian families are obviously doing that. I don't think it's probably quite as expensive as people will make it out to be. I know the numbers do sound quite large, but you know, I say a number like it's $350,000. That's a lot of money, obviously, but they're also talking about the typical family earning about probably $2.5 million over the course of 18 years or so. So I think it's obviously quite doable. We've been doing it in the past when we were a poorer country. So don't let that put you off too much if you can.
And Robin, thinking about, we've spoken a lot about Ariane today, and you're obviously so proud of her. I wonder how Mia felt about the sacrifices the family made.
And look, that's a really important consideration, and something that when we made the decision, it was the family making the decision, which is, you know, would Ariane move up to Queensland on her own and maybe board at a college, or what did we, the four of us, feel was the best option? And we were unanimous in the move. And that was Mia's buy-in as well, because she then could see where she would fit into this, and she would be able to then pave her way in a new city and a new state as well. But she also could witness the love that her sister had for this sport and how committed she was and how talented she was. But you do really need to consider all your children and how you can give to each and every one of them in a different way, whatever that might be, which path they decide to take. And, you know, we had countless times where we would take the girls to Hobart, for instance, for swimming, and then Mia needed to be back in Launceston 2.5 hours away the next morning for a track and field event at Little Athletics, and her father got up early with her and drove her back, and then she won a silver medal, and then they jumped in the car and came back and she swam in Hobart again. So look, it's something that you really do need to think about. You don't want to not show favouritism, but maybe focus on one child if you have more than one, and make it a family experience. And luckily, you know, Mia's never had a jealous bone in her body. She's always been so happy for her sister, and that makes us pretty proud as well that we've been able to get through that journey with Mia not feeling like she was on the outer, that she was very included in Ariane's career too.
Robin, Ben, thank you both so much for sharing your experience and wisdom with us today. Robin Titmus is the very proud mum to Olympian Ariane Titmus and to Mia. And Associate Professor Ben Phillips is from ANU's Centre for Social Policy Research. And I've just loved your texts this morning as well. One says, my mum set up an investment account instead of gifts and buying coffees. Kids are 5 and 7, and now they each have $2,000 plus. Mum buys gifts at the op shop instead of new gifts, and she spends her time for the kids and cooks for them with love. My beautiful mum is so generous. Well, coming up next, sort of staying with kids and toxic chemicals from very popular online retailers in some toys. That's next.
during an emergency.
Almost 24 hours with no power, no hot water, no Wi-Fi, no nothing.
For the information you need when you need it.
Power's not on, the line's still down, the tree's still on it.
No internet reception at all and no TV reception even with our generator.
Find your local ABC radio station.
Thank goodness for you guys, we've got a battery radio and keep up to date.
ABC Radio is your emergency broadcaster.
I am sorry to ask this already, but have you started your Christmas shopping yet? If you're already adding things to your cart, maybe cute toys for the kids or grandkids, the colourful ones that are water resistant and stain resistant, well, you might want to think again because a new report out of Europe has shown that a few big name companies are creating kids' toys that might have harmful levels of chemicals on them, which is obviously not good news. But at this point, is it even possible to avoid nasty chemicals that are already out there in the world? With me is Dr. Rachel Wakefield-Rann, Research Principal at the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology, Sydney. Rachel, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Tegan. Thanks for having me.
So you weren't involved in this report, but it's very much in your wheelhouse. Can you tell me what it's all about?
Yeah, sure. So the reports come out from a consumer rights group called Euroconsumers that are based in the EU, and they found evidence of widespread and really alarming failures in the safety of children's products that are sold on online digital marketplaces, so places like Shein and Temu. And these failures include things like choking hazards, flammability, and the presence of hazardous chemicals. So really, really concerning stuff, although maybe not entirely surprising.
Yeah, I think the one that I'm sort of interested to hear is what you mean by hazardous chemicals. How dangerous are we talking?
They don't go into a huge amount of detail here. They mention heavy metals directly, but the types of chemicals that are often found through independent testers in children's products include PFAS chemicals, different groups of
forever chemicals.
Retardants. Yeah, that's forever chemicals, sorry. And also things like bisphenol, so a lot of people would know BPA and BPS, and phthalates are another big one. So they're just some of the ones that are kind of coming up pretty regularly in independent testing.
Those are chemicals that people are concerned about, but they are in a lot of goods that we already have a lot of contact with in our daily lives. How is the risk of exposure to these through kids' toys different to what a kid might be encountering throughout their life?
Okay, so there's a couple of things. So kids are more vulnerable to exposures, so it's kind of just worth mentioning that to start with. So because of the way that kids interact with the world, they're kind of crawling around on the grounds, inhaling kind of dust particles close to the ground. They're putting everything in their mouths, and they just have this kind of greater contact level with products. So exposure via any products is going to be greater with kids, and also their capacity to process these products is far reduced compared to adults, and that's because their organs are still developing and they just have smaller bodies. So the risk to kids is higher as well. So that goes for any products, really. But for toys, I guess the intention of toys is that the kids are really, really directly interacting with them. So they're, you know, any kid really under the age of two, you can expect any toy is going to go in their mouth. And that, you know, is probably also the case for lunchboxes. So I strongly advocate that anything that's designed to come in contact with a kid is safe to put in a kid's mouth. But toys are an interesting category as well because they are likely to have probably quite a few plasticizer chemicals added to them. And plasticizer chemicals are the chemicals that we add to plastics to make them colorful, bendy, basically anything we want the plastic to be. And some of the other qualities, such as stain resistance, water resistance, resistance to fire and flames, the chemicals used to make the plastics resistant to those things are often really concerning. So PFAS, again, forever chemicals is one example of the chemicals added to prevent those things. So based on what people want from toys, there is kind of a high probability that there might be some of these chemicals added.
When we're talking about the sorts of toxins that you're referring to, things like flame retardants or other things that change the nature of a plastic toy. What kind of health effects are we worried about here?
Yeah, so there's quite a broad range. So one category of harm, I suppose, is carcinogens or mutagens. So they're kind of cancer-causing products. There's also a range of endocrine-disrupting products. So they're the types of chemicals that will disrupt your hormonal system, and your hormone systems are responsible for a whole range of bodily functions. So anything related to reproduction and development, certain types of cancers. And then there are also kind of neurodevelopmental and neurological issues associated with a number of these products, but it's difficult to say in a really specific way, this chemical is associated with this outcome, because there are just thousands of these chemicals, so we'd have to kind of spend quite a long time going through each individual one. But broadly, they're the types of health outcomes that have been associated with those categories of chemicals.
Are these the sorts of health outcomes that we'd be likely to see in an acute sense, like within a couple of hours or days of a child playing with a toy like this? Or is it sort of just like this lifetime accumulative risk that might not show up until years or decades down the track?
Yeah, that's right. That's a really good question. It's one that I think has probably inhibited fast action on this. So a lot of the health effects are long-term and they are cumulative, but also there's what's often called cocktail effects. So there's a number of chemicals combining to produce novel effects in people's bodies. And also there's a bit of an old saying in chemistry that's quite outdated now, that is that the dose makes the poison. So there's an assumption that the higher the dose of something, the worse the effect. But a number of people now advocate for that to be switched to the timing makes the poison. So kids go through these kind of critical development windows when they're vulnerability to being affected by particularly endocrine disrupting chemicals actually changes. So when DNA is being kind of activated to release hormones and do different things at particular times, you're particularly vulnerable to being affected by a chemical that's mimicking a hormone, for example, during that time. So it could be kind of a one-off or like a kind of limited time frame that a kid is exposed in that could have a great impact, or it could be a cumulative impact over many years that produces these kind of harmful outcomes. So because these chemicals are so ubiquitous and because they have different effects depending on like the timing of the exposure and the body that they're exposed to, it's really hard to say definitively, you know, if you always consume chemical X at this rate, you'll always get X type of cancer because it doesn't manifest that way in the real world.
You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Rachel Wakefield-Rand, who's the research principal at the Institute for Sustainable Futures at University of Technology Sydney, about a new report out of Europe just showing how many harmful chemicals there are on kids' toys. I wonder if it makes you think differently about how you buy, or if this is something that you're already considering. Do you have a rule book for how you choose toys and presents that help you avoid the bad stuff? Rachel, this report's measuring these products against European standards. How does that compare to standards in Australia?
It's an interesting category, I suppose, because when people go onto these kind of online marketplaces, they're not buying from a shop in Australia, they're buying from an online marketplace. And the ACCC here in Australia does offer some protection. I'm not an expert in consumer law, I'll just note that. But I do know that they have identified shopping from these kind of online platforms as a safety priority this year. But at this stage, the protections aren't as great as the EU. So the EU has a recently updated kind of regulatory framework called the General Product Safety Regulation, and that goes a lot further in terms of requiring detailed technical documentation, traceability, from these online marketplaces. And they also apply what we call the precautionary principle, which ensures that products must be deemed safe before they're even sold, even if all potential risks aren't fully known. And they do a range of things to kind of help ensure compliance to this. And one of them is this kind of extensive monitoring and use of kind of third-party testers and things like that that will help ultimately pick up on these breaches and safety concerns that we see in this report.
So if you're shopping for kids' toys, what are some of the things you can look out for to be choosing safer products?
Well, the first thing I always say when asked this question is that parents and grandparents really shouldn't be required to have chemistry degrees or access to a lab in order to ensure that their products are safe. And at the moment, there's just very, very few assurances that what we're buying online from these types of marketplaces are safe. So I guess the first thing I'd say is please put greater pressure on your members of parliament and others to just ask, say, can you please help ensure these regulations are tightened so that there are greater protections to ensure that anything we buy to import into Australia is safe. So I think that's always got to be the first step. But for now and for when we're kind of shopping, I'd say there's kind of three main strategies that you could employ. The first would be to, instead of going to one of these online marketplaces, shop from a retailer that you have some trust in. And that trust can be established through the claims that are made on, say, a retail website where they say that they only allow products that have been tested by third-party certification systems or that provide additional assurances that enable you to trust that anything on that website is safe and tested. The second thing you can look out for is labelling on the products themselves. So there are a number of third-party labelling schemes that also provide assurances, one of which is kind of an EU one called CE, and it's a pretty basic level of assurance to show that it complies with EU standards, but that does offer kind of some comfort. So that's just a kind of simple label that says the letter C and the letter E. And the third thing is, I guess, to kind of become familiar with the types of claims that are made on products that may have these chemicals in them. So any plastic product that's advertised as being stain, water or flame resistant, I would be quite suspicious of. And then plastic products that are kind of like sticky or foamy or generally non-porous, they're probably a little bit more likely to have things added to them just to give them those kind of affordances that we can see. So it's not a fail-safe measure, but may help a little bit guide some of that decision-making.
Rachel, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Tegan.
Dr. Rachel Wakefield-Rand is the Research Principal at the Institute for Sustainable Futures at University of Technology Sydney. Thank you for your text. One says, plastic toys are made from fossil fuels. Have plastic-free houses and children. It's a challenge. Well, that's almost it for Life Matters coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Earlier in the show, we talked about the best money you could spend on your kids. And the number of texts that you've sent me on this have been a large in number and very large in heart. One says, Jay says, we have a dancer and a violinist, both studying at high level, lots of love, time and money needed to make it happen. Best choice for us. We're not big income earners, but have focused around kids' needs. Another says, children and money, swimming pool entry, taught them to swim, priceless, and they get such enjoyment. Another says, interstate holidays to spend time with grandparents. Anna says, dentistry, a gift to last a lifetime. Another says, all this talk about getting kids to experience and do so many things, our kids also had a range of things that they were involved in over many years, but one experience that's critical and doesn't cost a cent is having enough time to be bored and think and work out how to occupy their time and what they like to do with whatever resources they have. We also spoke earlier in the show about ways to share the benefits of solar power and green energy for people who don't have a roof that they can put solar panels on. One person says, "We have been on an electrification journey, including an EV, and have solar and a battery. It's great to see our solar stored and be able to cover peak times when power is expensive. The upfront investment was well worth it and good for the planet." Thanks, Dave, for that text. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the fact that our tips are running out of space. Our land fills our land full. As we come into our most consumption-heavy time of year, do we need to rethink how we manage our waste? Plus, as an organ recipient, what do you owe your donor in how you treat your body? And what's the difference between being a Nepo baby and following in your parents' footsteps like almost all of us used to do? Don't forget, you can email me anytime. I love to get your emails, lifematters@abc.net.au. And I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.